This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A violent crime in New York City over the weekend has turned the holiday season here into a moment of anxiety and reflection on the issue of law enforcement and community trust. Here are the details. A profoundly disturbed drifter from Baltimore named Ismael Brinsley shot his ex-girlfriend with a 9mm pistol, boarded a bus to New York City, and ended up in Brooklyn, where he targeted two NYPD officers with four shots while they were sitting in their vehicle in the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood on Saturday afternoon. Officers Wenjian Liu and Rafael Ramos died, and shortly afterward, Brinsley shot and killed himself at a nearby subway station. The tragedy of that violent crime is compounded by the fact that moments before the shooting, Baltimore police tracking a suspect issued a warning that Brinsley was armed, dangerous, and in Brooklyn. But the warning was too late. And the lingering echo of this crime comes from a deranged Instagram post from Mr. Brinsley himself on Saturday. "I'm putting wings on pigs today," it wrote. "They take one of ours, let's take two of theirs. Hashtag shoot the police." By linking his acts to police incidents in Missouri and Staten Island, Brinsley has opened a rift between political leaders and police here in New York City. And following the shooting and the dangerous exchange of words in its aftermath is WNYC reporter Bridget Bergen. Bridget, welcome.
Hi, John.
So take the pulse of New York City, and how does it reflect a wider debate and discussion about this sense of trust between law enforcement and political leaders?
Well, what we have seen here in New York ever since the grand jury's verdict in the Eric Garner case specifically, and that was, of course, the case where they decided not to bring criminal charges against a police officer in what was a chokehold death that was caught on videotape. We've seen protests on the city streets almost nightly ever since then. And so a growing sense of passion and organization among people who have been calling for reform within the police department. That comes up against sort of a growing sentiment among people within the NYPD and some supporters of wanting the mayor to make a stronger statement that he supports the department, that he thinks that what they've been doing and the work that they do is important. He respects it. He values it. What you hear is the mayor has been trying to balance both those sentiments, saying it's important for the democratic process to allow for protest, while at the same time acknowledging that the NYPD has done really up to now an amazing job dealing with the constant protests on the streets, dealing with them peacefully, giving people some space to vent, while he also tries to bring some reform to the department, you know, doing some wholesale retraining and changing some of the policies that have been problematic in the past.
At no point had the protesters here in New York or generally around the country been calling for violence against the police, right?
Absolutely not. If anything, they had been saying that violence took away from their cause. There was one incident on the Brooklyn Bridge not long ago where two police officers were assaulted, and that has, again, added to the tension between City Hall and some within the NYPD. We also are hearing a lot from the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association President Patrick Lynch, who has really been ratcheting up the rhetoric in terms of how he says his officers are being treated by this administration.
And we should say that the anxiety among police around the country and in New York is understandable in this time post-Eric Garner. But what about this rhetoric? Patrick Lynch saying, you just mentioned him there, "There is blood on many hands tonight, those that incited violence on the street under the guise of protest." And he says that blood is on the hands of City Hall and Mayor de Blasio himself.
To give a little context for that statement and really to show how pointed it was, this is a comment that he made at the hospital the night that these two officers had died and, you know, came right after the mayor and the police commissioner were talking about the circumstances in the investigation that they were now commencing. We have heard Lynch make really aggressive statements towards the administration in the past. About a week earlier, he had suggested that members sign an affidavit that would say that if they died in the line of duty, they didn't want the mayor and the city council speaker to attend their funeral.
Which raises a huge issue. De Blasio has to go to the funeral of these officers, and there will be a confrontation.
He absolutely plans to go to it. It's something that I asked his spokesman yesterday, and certainly it is a sign of respect. It's something that the mayor of the city of New York will and should do. Whether or not there is a conflict is something that the mayor has to deal with up to this point. He's had maintained a very public presence with his police commissioner, Bill Bratton. Yesterday, they attended Mass together at St. Patrick's Cathedral. And at one point, Cardinal Dolan said from the altar, he asked Commissioner Bratton and his chief of detectives, James O'Neill, to bring a message back to the NYPD that people loved them, people supported them, people cared about them. And would he please bring that message back? And almost spontaneously, the church erupted into applause. Mm. There is certainly support for the department. There are people who want to make the department better and continue to call for reforms. And Mayor de Blasio is stuck there in the middle, trying to keep both of those sides from going after each other.
Work, tension, and a reconciliation that definitely is going to be a theme of this holiday season here in New York City and around the nation. Bridget Bergen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bridget Bergen is a reporter for our partner producing station, WNYC News. Here is a sample of public reaction to the shooting of two police officers over the weekend. This is from a vigil of mourning, candles, and prayer at the site of officers Lou and Ramos' death in Brooklyn.
I came out tonight just to be with the community, to say that we want justice for Eric Garner or we want justice for Mike Brown does not mean that we want violence against police, because we're all New Yorkers, you know, and this hurts all of us.
Pastor Craig Williams of the neighborhood Greater St. Stephen's United Church of God, who said he has fond memories of the police when he was a young boy. And here is local resident Jocelyn Leach.
Well, my boyfriend is a police officer, retired. And when I heard the news, I was extremely shocked because I pretty much had a flashback of what could have happened to him. And I feel really bad for the family that's affected here. Words can't explain how much my heart breaks for them, for their loss.
Former 22-year veteran NYPD officer and Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams spoke with reporters yesterday at the scene of the killings.
That bullet that hit the body of those two officers are continuing to travel emotionally throughout this entire community. Children will leave these buildings and walk down this block to school or to other places, to church, and they will have to reflect on this.
Indicative of the tensions in New York City, the New York Post reported that a retired cop reacted to Adams yesterday by angrily calling his statement a cheap political stunt. Columnist and longtime voice of the New York Street, former Village Voice writer Stephen Thrasher, is now a weekly columnist with The Guardian and joins us. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
Is the de Blasio administration sort of being tested right now in terms of leadership?
Definitely. There are, as Bridget was just saying, there are emotions that one would expect. And as you said, voices that are very loud after a police officer is killed, understandably so. But PBA President Lynch really set the stage for a lot of confrontation by sending out that emotionally manipulative letter asking people to sign away banning the mayor from their hypothetical future funeral. So that ratcheted up the rhetoric a lot. Also, I was reporting on Friday night at a pro-police rally, which had a counter-protest outside of City Hall. And while it was very small, it did show context of a lot of tension that would have come, obviously, much more so less than 24 hours later when two police officers were killed.
I'm wondering if Lynch reflects an actual sense on the part of the NYPD that they're not getting any support in the wake of the Eric Garner case. I mean, if you look at Mayor de Blasio's background, he's got a biracial son. He had to sort of acknowledge that this issue of cop fear in communities is something that's real in his family. What could he have said if he'd said, the jury has spoken, the grand jury has spoken, no indictment, we live with the system and move on, I support the police? He would have angered another constituency.
Of course. There's nothing that he could have said that would have pleased everybody. But that's one of the interesting things I've seen about the response to all these protests, is that the groups who are, in this case, the PBA here in New York, outside of the context of the killing on Saturday, but before that, the groups always find some reason to complain about protesters. They'll say in the Mall of America, you can't stop people from shopping. And in Ferguson, they'll say you're not doing anything constructive. And the PBA, who speaks for some cops, but not all, I've talked to cops who say he doesn't speak for them. But obviously, when you see police officers in uniform turning their back on the mayor of the city of New York, you have to be very concerned, which happened at the hospital on Saturday night. You have to be very concerned about the relationship between the civilian command and the NYPD itself.
But if you're a journalist, right, and two journalists are shot sitting in their car by someone who posts an Instagram saying, I hate free speech, they slandered my reputation for some story or slight in the past. As a journalist, you'd be looking for support statements and be terrified to walk the streets.
In such situations, I think it's important to listen to the people who are directly involved, but not let them direct the entire policy in ways that could be counterproductive. So, of course, it's very obvious that the police are very spooked right now, and I'm spooked that they're spooked. We have a police force of 35,000 people, and they're the ones who have the guns, and they might be feeling much more afraid right now. And that's why I don't think it's a good idea for somebody like PBA Lynch to be throwing gasoline on the fire, that they need to show a leadership that's going to create more calm and not sort of escalate the cycle of violence.
Is this possibly a failure of leadership on both sides, though, in the sense that this is more like Sandy Hook? This is really an opportunity to say availability of guns is what caused this. That's the deal. Nobody said a word.
No, there are all kinds of things like that. You're right, John, that could be brought up. And what I found in reporting in Ferguson, which I've been in St. Louis a couple times this year and here in New York, is that there's a very different dynamic, right? If you have a Sandy Hook, if you have school shootings, you'll at least have people looking at the children involved and feeling sympathetically about them. I found when I was in Ferguson, there was no sympathy about the black children that were also in the same neighborhood where Mike Brown was killed. And I think we do need to elicit empathy and sympathy in these situations. And there hasn't been a lot of leadership at looking at the broader issues. So when you have,
but you're sliding away from it too. This is a mentally unstable person with a gun who causes a huge incident. That's exactly the same as Sandy Hook. The issue in Ferguson didn't involve a gun, except that a cop had the gun there. I mean, this we wouldn't be talking about Ferguson if it wasn't for somebody with a gun.
Right. The point I was trying to make is that there are broader issues, including the issue of mental health, including the issue of gun violence, including the issue of poverty and the marginalization of people. Those are legitimate issues that we have to step back and look at more broadly. And you're right. We don't want to look at them. We don't want to hear leadership about them. And the PBA is not going to go in tight on looking at those kinds of things. There's a lot of new and there's a lot to be looked at. But we do have to consider that this was a very unstable man who was at the margins of the law. And the NYPD wants to have a monopoly on violence. I mean, it's what you're saying.
Monopoly on victimhood here.
On victimhood, and in Ferguson as well. You're right. Somebody had a gun. Generally, the status quo says it's okay as long as the police have guns. And now that the police are facing gun violence as well, it sort of flips the narrative, which can make them more trigger happy or not.
In the complexity and the intensity of feeling surrounding this incident over the weekend. Stephen Thrasher, weekly columnist at The Guardian. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Last week's violent attack against students at a school in Peshawar, Pakistan, that killed 145 people assures an escalation of fighting between the Pakistan military and the Taliban that has been fighting a parallel war from the Taliban fighters across the border in Afghanistan. Where are both of these conflicts headed? We turn now to Alexander Evans, who's coordinator of the United Nations Al-Qaeda Taliban Monitoring Team. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So, first of all, in Peshawar, the Taliban in Pakistan have really escalated a conflict that they say was an answer to an initiative, an offensive last summer. What can we expect in the next 12 months?
Well, the Pakistani Taliban, which is sort of a motley group of militants, primarily from Pakistan's tribal areas, are actually on the back foot. They've been pushed back by the Pakistan army. They're under pressure. And the Peshawar attack that we saw is just one example of them striking back at soft targets because they don't have the strength to strike back at harder targets. The degree of political unity that this attack has generated in Pakistan is almost unprecedented. The level of condemnation of a group of terrorists who come in and kill a wide range of school children, clearly innocent targets in a terrorist attack, argues well that there can be a new approach to counterterrorism in Pakistan, one that even furthers the work that Pakistan's already done to contain some of these groups in the tribal areas.
And allies of the Pakistanis are across the border in Afghanistan. What's the distinction between the Taliban in Pakistan and in Afghanistan? And are they, in fact, rivals at this moment?
So the Afghan Taliban operate in Afghanistan. They have a presence in parts of Pakistan as well. But they're very, very much focused on the campaign in Afghanistan. They have attacked civilians. They have caused civilian casualties. But they wouldn't necessarily celebrate it in the same way publicly as the Pakistan Taliban have with this attack in Peshawar. So they share similar ideology, but the Pakistan Taliban basically have much harder ties with other groups, including al-Qaeda.
And in Afghanistan, is it an opportunity now for the Taliban as the U.S. forces pack up and leave at the end of this year?
Well, the Afghan Taliban think it is going to be an opportunity, the process of transition, the withdrawal of many foreign troops. But in fact, the Afghan National Security Forces have done remarkably well. The Afghan Taliban haven't been able to seize any towns. They haven't been able to control on a sustained basis any urban territory. And so long as the money keeps flowing from the international community, and so long as there's still confidence within Afghanistan in the Afghan government, the Afghan Taliban themselves don't look like they're going to make any gains soon.
Is it your recommendation to the United Nations, and is it the position of the United Nations, insofar as you can speak to that, that Pakistan is moving towards greater stability in the coming months, and that Afghanistan will not end up in the situation that it was in before 2001?
Well, I can't speak for the United Nations, but in my view as an expert, the situation in both Afghanistan and Pakistan is more positive than many pundits have it. Many folk have predicted the implosion of Afghanistan. That hasn't happened yet. Many folk have predicted the implosion of Pakistan, and that hasn't happened yet. The challenge moving forward is how are these two countries going to functionally cooperate and really take the fight against terrorist and militant groups that one step further.
All right, if you believe that Afghanistan shifting across the border will not return to a situation like it was in 2001, where the Taliban pretty much controlled things. The U.S. left Iraq, and some months later, 2 years later, we had ISIS or ISIL. What could be the scenario inside Afghanistan with the U.S. pulling out?
Well, look, we are, as an expert group, we are worried about the growth of militant presence in Afghanistan, and that includes a range of groups affiliated to or with links to al-Qaeda core. But at the same time, the Afghan government and the Afghan National Security Forces have done a much better job than people anticipated. The U.S. is committed to continue to provide air support to the Afghan National Security Forces, and that's a crucial ingredient over the next year or two. While I'm going to be cautious about predicting a future, I've done it occasionally in the past and it's easy to get it wrong, I think it is clear that all the countries in South Asia have a shared interest in not seeing Afghanistan return to the civil war of the 90s or indeed the Taliban government of the late 1990s.
Alexander Evans is coordinator of the United Nations Al-Qaeda Taliban monitoring team. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sounds of the war against the Taliban in Afghanistan that began just weeks after 9/11 back in 2001. This is shooting from the battle for Mazar-e-Sharif, one of the early victories against the Taliban, in a war that started as a rout and has settled into the controlled chaos of Afghanistan today, 13 years later. Throughout much of that time, National Public Radio has kept a bureau in Kabul, a bureau that is closing as U.S. forces leave Afghanistan to a fate that may take it back to the days of 2001.
It's a history that war-weary Afghans are hoping will not be repeated. Sean Carberry, NPR News, Kabul.
Reporter Sean Carberry has locked the doors of the building housing the NPR bureau and returned the keys to the landlord. NPR has had reporters in Afghanistan throughout the conflict. The 24/7 bureau opened in 2006. And Carberry says the players are different today in Kabul as the bureau closes, but Afghanistan, he says, still has to prove it can go it alone.
A lot of questions still to be asked and answered about what's going to happen with this new government, with security next year. Are they going to be able to build an economy? So it's still a very transitional time in Afghanistan, and I'm personally curious to see where it's going to go at this point.
How has the sort of feeling on the ground in Kabul and in Afghanistan generally changed as the American tone, particularly among retiring military, seems to be that militarily speaking, the whole operation in Afghanistan has amounted to very, very little?
Well, certainly in the 2.5 years that I was there, I would say security in Kabul probably stepped backwards a little bit. And around the rest of the country, some areas improved, other areas have deteriorated. So it's a bit of a push across the country in the last couple of years. And with the drawdown, with the handover to Afghan forces, the Afghan army are a decent fighting force. U.S. commanders say they've held their own over the last year, but holding your own against an insurgency that has no intention of letting up isn't necessarily a great grade. Then when you get to the Afghan police, they're still a much younger, weaker force. They have a lot of vulnerabilities. They've been taking incredible numbers of casualties over the course of this year. And beyond that, the Afghan security forces still lack a lot of support capabilities in terms of logistics, maintenance, intelligence. And that's an area of significant concern for foreign military, that the Afghan forces still can't really operate fully on their own. And that's going to take time to continue to build that capability.
The departure from Iraq brought us ISIS. I'm wondering if people say that there's an expectation that the Taliban will once again control Afghanistan sometime in the next decade or so.
It's certainly a belief that it could happen. It's not – the dynamics aren't exactly the same as Iraq. There are a lot of different dimensions to it. One is the fact that the Taliban have always been a domestic actor with domestic aspirations. So on one level, they're not looking to expand across the region the way ISIS has. But the problem with them is their past track record of allowing al-Qaeda or other organizations to operate in the country. But the likelihood of them completely taking over is a bit doubtful. There are parts of the country that they control now. The likelihood, though, that they're going to come rolling into Kabul anytime in the next couple of years and take over the capital, very, very slim odds of that happening. The greater question is, what kind of political accommodation might there be in the future if the Taliban continue to put pressure on the government, continue to be strong in parts of the country? Will this new government under President Ashraf Ghani make substantial concessions to them, possibly even give them cabinet positions as an incentive to stop the fighting and join the political process?
How has the reputation of the United States changed or evolved in the time that you've been there? 2 years ago, it was a much different period than it is now. And you leave as the Senate report on torture is circulating among, I suspect, the emails of people in Kabul and around the country.
Well, one of the things that's changed in a positive direction for the U.S. is the new administration. President Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah, the government CEO, both much more pro-U.S., pro-Western than President Hamid Karzai was. And his rhetoric over the last couple of years was increasingly negative, increasingly accusing the U.S. of intentionally destabilizing the country, of collaborating with the Taliban. So that constant drumbeat of rhetoric from Karzai was not helping. So there's a bit of a reset that's happening right now. There are still plenty of detractors of the U.S. in Afghanistan. There are plenty of Afghans who want continued engagement. In fact, a lot of Afghans were very concerned about the drawdown plans for the next couple of years, saying that U.S. forces should stay indefinitely as long as help is needed rather than this 2-year drawdown. So, again, a mixed picture that there are a lot of people in certain villages, people who have seen a lot of violence, people who have seen U.S. or NATO airstrikes in their communities, who are against any foreign presence. But a lot of people there recognize that the Afghan government and the Afghan military are far from being able to run the country safely and securely on their own and want continued foreign assistance.
In the closing down of the Bureau, I'm wondering if there are Afghans loyal to NPR for all these years who are anxiously hoping for a call for, you know, someone to come back in and do some reporting. Is the NPR logo etched on some desk somewhere in Kabul?
No, not quite. We had a carpet that was made by a local carpet maker that was hanging in the office, and that's been lowered. And at this point, the local staff that that had worked with us for years are trying to figure out what's next for them, like many Afghans. I mean, this drawdown has affected contractors who worked with the military. A lot of the international organizations that have been operating there are decreasing their staff. So a lot of Afghan local staff are getting laid off at this time. And with my guys, I'm still in communication with people back in Kabul trying to find new jobs for them. But it's a very tough market right now.
Sean Carberry, outgoing Kabul correspondent for National Public Radio. Did you turn out the lights when you left?
Pretty much, yes.
Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome, John.
It's the end of the year. It's the end of the year.
If you understand anything about football, the game starts in the trenches.
We will get our house in order first.
Violence of any kind, especially man on woman, is just not right.
Pretty much in the league, families, wives, children, we were seen but not heard.
So we have another NFL player is in hot water.
The St. Louis Rams select Michael Sam.
We can use the NFL to help create change.
The National Football League delivered up a real contest last night in the battle for first place in the NFC West, but in the end, it was no contest for the defending Super Bowl champs, the Seattle Seahawks. They defeated the Arizona Cardinals 35-6. The NFL will no doubt be relieved to see the playoff season begin in a week. The Ray Rice domestic violence controversy this year, the Adrian Peterson child abuse controversy, even the question of an openly gay player on the field were all deeper social issues that challenged the NFL's position of leadership in American culture and entertainment in 2014. Former Minnesota Vikings punter Chris Cluey says he learned the hard way that political and social advocacy can be bad in a multi-billion dollar league that might prefer to keep out of the spotlight. After Cluey wrote an open letter declaring his support for same-sex marriage, he claims that he was released from the team for his views. Cluey says that mistake-filled 2014 showed that the NFL hates change and that while league management may be obsessed with the NFL's image, they sometimes seem not to have a clue of how to defend it.
I think there are a lot of people who use the idea of the NFL to justify internalized misogyny or homophobia because they look at it and they say, you know, hey, what's stopping me from doing this? Because this is this, you know, boys club atmosphere that I don't really have to be accountable for my behavior. I really do think that this is something that as a society we've decided that we're no longer okay with outright discrimination and intolerance, and we're expecting our businesses to follow along with that decision, and we're seeing a lot of birthing pains with that right now.
There's one division in the NFL that may finish the season with no team having a winning record, and one of those teams will go to the playoffs. Given that, do you buy Michael Sam's argument that he's not in the NFL because he's gay, not because of anything to do with talent, because there doesn't appear to be an abundance of talent on a lot of these teams this year?
Yeah, and I do agree with him, and I think it's unfortunate because I've had experience with the type of homophobia. Even though I myself am not gay, I merely spoke out on same-sex rights, but I've had experience with that in the NFL, and it is something that exists because it's something that exists in society itself. And the NFL isn't just this isolated bubble where you have football players and coaches and front office people and that's all they are. It's no, we're human beings just like everyone else. We grow up and we're raised in the culture and society of the United States, whatever that happens to be. And for a lot of older executives and managers and coaches in the NFL, they tend to be white, they tend to be wealthy, and they were raised with a very specific mindset. And to their credits, some of them have gotten past it. Some of them understand now that, hey, this is an issue that needs to be dealt with. Just like we don't discriminate against skin color, we shouldn't discriminate against sexuality. But there's still plenty left that are in positions of power that make personnel decisions. And so I think that Michael Sam did not get a fair chance in the NFL. And I think it's very obvious based on his preseason performance and the performance of the teams out there that, you know, he deserves to be on a practice squad, if not out on the field.
In terms of the issues that plagued the NFL this year, domestic violence and disciplining of a child, those kinds of things, and homophobia that you talked about. You know, you've got Michael Vick, who, you know, went to prison, and he's back, and all is forgotten. I mean, the cynical PR view of how the NFL deals with this stuff is, okay, great, we'll crack down on them, we'll kick them out, and then we get to, like, ride them on their comeback trail. And so they'll all be back, and everything will be forgiven, and we'll forget about all this, and Rice and Adrian Peterson will all be playing, and who knows how long the scars will stay on the back of his, you know, his son.
And that's something that I think the NFL really needs to be held accountable for, is the fact that the NFL loves a redemption story, but the NFL doesn't always take the steps to ensure that that redemption story is legit. And so there's a very big difference between letting a guy off with a slap on the wrist and then saying, oh, look, he's changed his life, he's turned everything around, and actually making sure that that guy has access to resources and support groups that will help rehabilitate him. And I will say, to Michael Vick's credit, he seems to have turned his life completely around. And that, I think, is a very good example of what the NFL can be at its best, is here's a guy who made a mistake, he knows what he did was wrong, and he's working to change it and be a positive role model for millions of people out there. And that's, you know, that's a powerful message, because people regard athletes as role models. Now, another very powerful message is if you have a guy who abuses his wife or abuses his children, and you essentially say, well, we're going to give you a 2-game suspension, and then you can come back and play football, and we'll treat it like a redemption story. Well, that sends the message that is the complete opposite effect, because it's a very negative message. It tells women out there, no, you're not safe from your husbands, because your husband's role model is abusing his wife and got away with it.
Well, on the 2-game suspension reference that you made, that brings up Goodell, Roger Goodell, the head of the NFL, the commissioner of the NFL. Do you think somewhere in the NFL bylaws there's a job description for the commissioner of the NFL, which basically says, just make us money, we don't care about anything else? How do you think he did? What's your assessment?
I think up until this point, he has been doing an excellent job from the owner's perspective in making them money and growing the sport, and taking all sorts of blows that were meant for the owners, but Goodell steps in front of and says, I'm the commissioner, take a swing at me. I think that with the concussion issue, I think that with the Ray Rice issue, and now the fact that it's become pretty obvious that Goodell lied. Goodell said that Ray Rice told him a different story, and a judge hearing the appeal said, no, he told you everything he knew and you just didn't make a good decision. I think that kind of stuff the owners are not very happy about, because it shakes public confidence in the NFL. And the NFL really could have avoided a lot of this if they had just said, look, we made a mistake. We miscalculated how important domestic violence is to society. We're going to change that. I think Goodell did lie about this situation. I think he's shown that he's unfit to be the commissioner of the league, especially as it pertains to the judgment of players who have gotten into trouble. And I really think that this is something that the NFL and the NFLPA need to sit down and hammer out a code of conduct in the CBA that makes it explicitly clear, here's what happens if you do something wrong, and here's the procedure by which it happens by.
So, on a lighter note, who do you think is going to win the Super Bowl, AFC or the NFC? Flip a coin, AFC or NFC?
Yeah, I have no idea. I think probably the best odds for an NFC team is the Packers. They look like they're firing on all cylinders. And then, I mean, you can't really count out the Patriots, because Brady still is obviously Tom Brady. And I think the Colts may have a chance. So maybe Packers, Patriots, or Packers, Colts.
Chris Cluey, former punter for the Minnesota Vikings, being a pundit on NFL predictions, and also talking about the past year in the NFL. Finally, with 3 days to go before Christmas, we've been talking about the holiday music we love and can't stand. Tomorrow, why does a pop holiday song like this one stick. That's tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.